Yes, Chair.
All right, it's 9 o'clock. Welcome, everybody. Today we've got a program which I think has been sent out to you. The first 30 minutes or so will be National Treasury responding to both the written and the oral submissions that were made before us on Wednesday. And then thereafter, we allocate about 30 minutes or so, I think, if I'm correct, to stakeholders, those who are present, and political help and Ellen, and identify them. And then we give Treasury a brief reply, and then we throw it open for discussion. So about an hour and 40 minutes, I gather, is allocated for discussion. Also, to remind participants from civil society that this is only one of three public hearings we have on the adjustments budget. The others are on the Division of Revenue next Friday, the 14th. And then I'm told on the 24th of this month also, there'll be hearings on the appropriations bill. So there's three different aspects of the public hearing. This is in response to C-19 in particular, but presumably the other civil society stakeholders as well, complaining about the lack of time. So you also, C-19 and others have a right to appear before the Appropriations Committee. In the case of C-19 in particular, both the committee secretary, Mr. Mangweni, and myself, referred it to Lubabalo, who actually, I spoke with him this morning and confirmed that he spoke to Sacha, I think, and they've invited C-19 to the 10th of July hearing next Friday, because many of their issues deal less with the fiscal framework, with macroeconomic issues, than with actually conditional grants. So they've been invited next Friday to take their issues forward, and the chairperson, Dick Lingoslang, is also part of this meeting to do a chief process that too. Having said that, Comrade Joe, co-chair, do you have anything you want to say before we hand over to Treasury?
No, not for now. You can proceed, Chairperson.
Okay, so the chairs have agreed that I'll do the first half and the co-chair will do the second half. So over then to Treasury. This was distributed, colleagues, comrades, this morning. So presumably some of you at least have had a chance to go through it. And then, of course, the Treasury will take us through it right now. So who's here from the Treasury team in Kuala Lumpur? Sorry?
The chairperson, Edgar CC, will do the presentation as far as
will others kindly mute their facility, please? We can hear a lot of...
Morning, James. Will you mute your...
I think it's Nicolo, is it? Yeah, no, it's all off now. Good, go for it. Edgar CC is there. Thank you. DDG...
Sorry, Jay, it's Willie Ogham speaking. Can I quickly say something, please?
Yeah, sure.
Mr. Chair, I've got a meeting with the Magistrates Commission that's also scheduled for today. It's a bit later, but if you would just excuse me, if I'm going to hop off at a certain stage, when we finish, I'll come back on this meeting as well.
Thank you so much for letting us know. Ah, yes, can we quickly take apologies in Kuala Lumpur? Anybody from the Select Committee side?
No apologies, Chair, from our side. Only it was Mr. Ogham.
Ah, yes, of course. And then on the side of the NA, Alan, any apologies?
No apologies, NA, Mr. Karim.
Okay, good. And you've notified all the stakeholders. You sent out that letter, and presumably those who can make it have made it today, right?
That's correct.
Okay, all right. You'll identify them when we come to their chance to respond. I did see Comrade Matthew Parks here. Okay, let's go over then to Treasury.
Chair, thank you very much. This is Dondo Mukhajani. Edgar, I'll just make a few remarks and Edgar will come back with your petition.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Chair. And honourable members, thank you for this opportunity to respond to the submissions made to this committee on the special adjustments budget tabled by the Minister of Finance on the 24th of June 2020. The Treasury strongly supports these public engagements on the budget, and the Treasury team is here to provide a comprehensive set of responses for today's hearing. Honourable Chair, the Parliament should not be deceived and misled. Our understanding of Parliament's process is that it is not only meant to be constructive while being robust, but it should also be fact-based and relevant. although these committees are a public platform, they should not be used to advance false, misleading, or politically self-serving motives by some other groups outside parliament and outside government. In our view, the submissions from certain groups, in particular the Budget Justice Coalition and the group of economists, are empirically false and misleading. They also adopt a tone of attack and dismissiveness which appears to reject the principle of social partnership in favor of media sensation. Their submissions have several factually inaccurate assertions which seem to be meant to be to deceive these committees. They also seem eager to launch baseless and politically motivated attacks against the National Treasurer and the Minister of Finance. I shall highlight just two examples of this. First, in its submission to the committee, the group of economists states that the budget reneges on, and I quote, budget reneges on the president's economic intervention measures as announced on the 21st of April 2020, in part because a large part of the budget is funded through reprioritization of the baseline allocations. Let me remind honourable members of the Parliament statement the President made, and I quote, the impact of the coronavirus requires an extraordinary budget of around 500 billion to direct resources towards fighting the pandemic, which will include the reprioritization of around 130 billion within the current budget, close quote. So, Chair, our budget is very much in line with the President's directive in this regard. In addition, the decision by the President and government at large to focus on reprioritization should be the decision by the President and government at large should be seen as a good initiative to target low priority, low efficiency and wasteful expenditure in the system and should be applauded as such. Yet the economist submission as well as by the Budget Justice Coalition falsely claim that the reprioritization comes from the Treasury in favor of a strategy of twisting the facts. Unfortunately, the Parliamentary Budget Office also seems to have fallen into the misguided view that spending should increase on a net basis by 500 billion, even though the President did not say this. But at least the public Parliamentary Budget Office does not go into the kind of misrepresentation of the two groups I'm talking about. They go so far as to tell members that, and I quote, it would be dereliction of duty for members to vote for the budget. This is not an argument. It is an attempted manipulation without empirical analysis, Chair. This brings me to the second observation. The Budget Justice Coalition and the group of economists seek to cast aspersions on government policy making in a manner seemingly designed to just score points. The Budget Justice Coalition claims that we have, and I quote, little understanding of the state's constitutional obligations, close quote. And the economists claim that what the minister tabled betrays the president. No data is provided to justify this, except that these groups don't like the way the money is allocated. These are political statements, not economic statements, and we wonder why they are being made here. There are other factually inaccurate assertions shared by this group, such as on tax relief and deliberate ignoring of key statements on the budget, such as on the job protection measure. But my main point, Chairperson, is that Parliament should be wary of allowing itself to be used as a platform for false misleading statements. In conclusion, Chair, the team will provide the detailed responses, but let me broadly reiterate the factual and empirical information regarding this supplementary budget. First, this budget raises government spending in response to the COVID pandemic. It allows the budget deficit to become huge and, frankly, unsustainable. Second, this budget responds to changing circumstances on the ground. So, for example, health receives more funding than what was announced in April. Third, government is exercising its responsibility to ensure sustainability and prevent a collapse in the public finances that many South Africans depend on. We are not a reckless national treasurer or a treasurer that will jeopardize the fiscal future of this country and future generations. We call on social partners to make meaningful contributions to our collective economic future. I thank you, Chair. And Chair, I would request that you give us the permission for Edgar to then give us a detailed response based on the submission and the presentation that is in front of the House. Thank you very much.
DG, firstly, are you going to be staying for the whole meeting?
Yes, Chair, I will be staying for the whole meeting, yes.
Okay, because I think as a Chair, I have to respond to what you say.
We have to respond, Chair, because we can't intimidate people who come and make submissions in Parliament.
Floyd, you have the right to speak, Floyd. Now you are intimidating the democratic process. I said, he just can't say these sweeping things. And almost, I mean, what I find quite offensive is not the substance of what you're saying, DG, but to suggest somehow that we will be misled, like we're naive, foolish, silly, immature people. I mean, there are activists here for over 50 years of standing. And I really think you're free to be robust. It's unprecedented for a DG in the 6 years I've been involved in this finance sector to speak the way you do. But look, robust discussion is allowed. But we will not, as Parliament, just make one point. There's no debate here. It's not something I'm saying individually. It's defined by the norms and the rules of Parliament and our constitution and the mass democratic struggle we wage to get where we are. People are free to say what they want. But Treasury, you are free also. I mean, usually it's a DM or a minister would say what you said, but fine. But please, you have no right to suggest that we will be used either by civil society or by yourselves, Treasury. We will hold you to rigorous account as well. And finally, DG, perhaps I should say this at the outset so that we get clear that Edgar Cici sticks to what the norm is. There's nothing wrong in economists being political. What's wrong with that? This is a political terrain. But you're free to say what you want to say, except that some of the things you're saying border on actually insulting the committee, DG, and perhaps the other members want to say something. But as a chair, I have no choice but to say it. I'm the chairperson for now. Comrade Joe, if you want to add now, you can. But otherwise, we'll give you a chance, Floyd, to speak. You can be the first speaker when the civil society has responded. But DG, you really have gone further than you should in terms of the norms in respect of your view of how people should engage with this parliament. Okay, over to you, Edgar Cici. You've got about 20 minutes, I think. Yeah, 23 minutes. Floyd, you'll be the first speaker when we get to the discussion part from this from the MPs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope you can hear me. I believe you should be able to hear me. This is our presentation, of course, our response to the submissions over the last couple of days. On the slide is just the list of the submissions as we have them, so I think they're known to members. Just some key comments that we gleaned from the public hearings over the last couple of days. Just in terms of the broad themes, we consider that the debate on the austerity versus stimulus is came out quite strongly. Secondly, issues of tax policy. Thirdly, on spending. Fourth, the reforms in terms of economic reforms. And then finally, the financing of government spending. Let me start with the fiscal policy issues and just outline some key facts which we have provided in a great deal of detail in the supplementary budget review, which was tabled on the 24th of June. First, information that were tabled before. Firstly, South Africa's fiscal stance has been expansionary for more than a decade. For many years, the spending of government has grown in real terms and has grown much faster than the economy and has grown faster than inflation. Since 2008, average spending of government has grown 4% annually every year in real terms, in other words, even accounting for inflation. And the supplementary budget presents the most expansionary budget in many years. It is an unprecedented expansion of the fiscal deficit and an unprecedented increase in government borrowings to a level that, as DG was saying, is frankly unsustainable. This expansion provides one of the most robust responses to the COVID pandemic among developing countries. all of the data that we have looked at from the OECD, from the IMF, the World Bank, various institutions, proves that this is the case. We have a large cyclically adjusted primary deficit that's bigger than a number of countries, including countries that are larger than ourselves, and the 10% of GDP support is larger than comparable countries in the G20. However, South Africa cannot use the pandemic as an excuse not to address the weak public finances and to achieve higher growth rates in the future. What we do know about government spending is that it's not a novel idea about what government spending has or has not done. We know that higher government spending has not translated into higher growth in the past decades. That is a fact. The austerity versus stimulus debate, however, is a false choice in our view, and the Treasury does not make policy according to this paradigm. And finally, the reprioritization approach that we have used is a prudent and appropriate approach to funding part of the relief measure. It was announced by the President on the 21st of April 2020. It is in line with practices in numerous countries worldwide. A number of countries are using reprioritization to fund their COVID responses. And finally, it provides an opportunity to address waste and reduce priority spending in government in respect of being able to redirect it towards the key areas. Some selected observations. Firstly, it is our view, Mr. Chairman, that the rejections of the active scenario that were tabled during the public submissions ignore the prospect and implications of a debt crisis. We noted that in many of the submissions where there was an injunction to spend, for government to spend even more, for the most part, there was no attempt to engage with the prospect of the debt crisis that we have put forward. And so we considered that the passive scenario that we outlined of a debt crisis has not been refuted in the submissions that were made, and neither have the implications of the debt crisis been refuted. And I suppose then our question is, if the prospect and implications of a debt crisis have not been refuted, on what basis should the active scenario be rejected? Secondly, while the consolidation effort will be challenging, there are upside risks in respect of the potential of economic growth measures that we are talking about, as well as improvements in inflation dynamics and the terms of trade. Third, calls for more government spending appear to us to be based on the incorrect assumption that South Africa suffers from short-run cyclical demand challenges rather than long-run structural weaknesses in the economy. Fourthly, higher government spending and borrowing, as I've said, has not led to higher growth in many years. And finally, we should not confuse people's desire to lend us money with our ability to pay it back. Turning to the debate on stimulus versus austerity, the COVID-19 economic response, as I've said, is massively countercyclical when measuring the size of the fiscal impact. We consider that government at this time only has a choice between a looming debt spiral or fundamental reform, and that no other option exists. We need fundamental reform. Thirdly, the policy of government is that a structural increase in the level of spending must be matched by increase in structural revenues. And in this regard, we consider that there is a structural gap between spending and revenue in government, and it's been there for many years. There are growth and distributional consequences to our choices. They include the fact that more borrowing does not translate necessarily into higher growth, and that hasn't been the case in a number of years. Fiscal stimulus cannot address underlying structural issues, and rising debt service costs are crowding out other areas of spending, and has been happening over time. And the increasing demands on foreign savings is raising our vulnerability to external shocks. It's also important to note that we accept the premise, and in this regard, we agree with COSATU and others who make the point that the quality of the borrowing is crucial, and that we have to focus on investment rather than consumption, and we have to make sure that we improve the efficiency of spending by government, which we've been doing. We need to accelerate these efforts. Spending reductions may cause short-term harm, of course, but the implications of a fiscal crisis would be profoundly negative. I do want to remind honourable members of the not only the gap now, but also the structural gap over many years between revenue and expenditure that we have to address. So, in terms of the debate around spending and the calls from the Parliamentary Budget Office, COSATU and others, to spend more, one of the things we have to consider are the facts. The first is the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated an already weak fiscal position, leaving very little fiscal space to respond. And this for us, Mr. Chairman, is the critical message that we draw from the current crisis. The message that we draw from the current crisis is not that you need to spend more and more and more, regardless of how indebted you are. It is about the importance of fiscal buffers. We were able to respond very well to the global financial crisis in 2008, partly because we have strong buffers. You have to build up buffers during the good times in order to make sure you can respond to a crisis. Because if you don't have buffers, then your response to the crisis is not only weak or jeopardized, but it potentially leads you to a crisis. Budget 2020 expected an already large deficit of 6.8% of GDP. This has now increased to a consolidated record of 15.7%. The gross borrowing requirement for 2020, which is the sum of the main budget deficit and the loans that are currently maturing, has increased by 344 billion to 777, just under 777 billion rand this year. Debt will peak at 87% in terms of our active scenario in 2020-23-24, compared to 50% in 2016-17, where it was at the time. And this is an active scenario. If we do nothing, it's of course over 100%. Now this adds to the already high levels of debt and increasing debt service costs to almost 22% of the main budget expenditure. We also consider that South Africa's tax to GDP is already high given country's level of development, and any additional taxes should be considered prudently. And in this regard, I would remind honourable members that our tax collections last year at 26.4% of GDP matched our all-time record as a percentage of the economy, and yet the fiscal gap still grew. And so much work needs to be done in this regard. Additional spending will require higher debt, and this comes with higher interest. And finally, rising debt service costs are crowding out our ability to pay for health and education services. Next year, payment on interest will be higher than spending on health, and the year after that, payment on interest will be higher than total spending on basic education in this country if we do nothing. As I reflected last week, Thursday, a debt crisis can have long-run implications, and this is a reminder of the conservative analysis that we have done. It shows what happens to debt over the decade and the debt service costs. And even more importantly, on the right-hand side, it shows that crisis could extract more than 2 trillion rands from the real economy if we do nothing. This is a slide, as you all know, that we showed many times, reflecting the different choices that we have. But we believe, Mr. Chairman and honorable members, that we can take steps to avoid the debt crisis, and we can place the economy in a path towards higher potential and real growth if we take action. One of the questions that was raised was around the usage of the government employees' pension fund to fund the response. And this slide seeks to provide some information in this regard so that I think we understand the sort of the nature of what we're talking about. The table above shows the income and expenditure of the GEPF, including employer and employees' contributions, as well as the benefits that the GEPF pays out. And you can see across the years how that looks. And immediately you can see how the benefits currently being paid, or that have been paid out over a number of years, have of course been steadily rising. And at the bottom you can see the actuarial valuation of the Government Employees Pension Fund. The GEPF exists to provide retirement security to about 1.3 million employees and 460,000 beneficiaries, right, and manage government's pension liabilities. Its funding position has, as you can see in these tables, steadily deteriorated since 2016, driven by lower than expected investment returns and introduction of new benefits and improvements to existing benefits. It's also important to note that investments by the fund are determined in terms of are determined by the Board of Trustees in terms of an Act of Parliament. And forcing the fund to invest in suboptimal assets will create a significant long-run liability for future generations. The fund is reliant on investment income to pay benefits. It is expected that the impact of credit ratings downgrades and the COVID-19 will adversely affect the fund's position. Let's also point out that it is our view, Mr. Chairman, that in order to achieve this, you do need to avoid spending debt that has been saved for tomorrow. I want to touch finally on the fiscal policy side. And others, that infrastructure needs to be a priority. And we are working to make it so. As honourable members will be aware, we tabled
sorry about that. Can the ICT people please help the IT people? There's these interruptions. But
muted the person.
Okay. Sorry.
We consider that interventions to support public infrastructure spending are very important. We, as we have tabled in a previous budget review, establish a 100 billion rand infrastructure fund as the Treasury. We're working very closely with the DBSA in that regard. And we also support the intervention of the Sustainable Infrastructure Development Symposium. We have a budget facility for infrastructure, which is an institutional process to appraise and evaluate large projects. And funding for the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Council, GTEC DPSA, to assist government institutions with project preparation and planning has been made available in budgets. We have an infrastructure delivery improvement program to provide technical assistance. And also we have a framework for infrastructure delivery and procurement management, which aims to build efficiencies in the system, including in procurement. And also we have established several local government grants that are designed to augment the infrastructure grants in order to support making the system more efficient. And finally, as I've indicated, the infrastructure fund's implementation unit has now been established in the DBSA. And it has identified potential projects in excess of 500 billion rands. And we are busy with a review of the public-private partnership framework of government. And in this regard, we welcome more initiatives and more support and more inputs into this process. Mr. Chairman, the next set of slides are around the tax policy issues that were raised by a number of the contributions that were made. Some comments stated that there should not be any increase in taxes while the economy recovers from the pandemic, while others called for additional tax measures to be introduced. The supplementary budget stated that there would be tax increases of 40 billion over the next 40 years, and that specifics in this regard will be announced in February. The Davis Tax Committee has done a number of research topics on this, a number of research reports on this, including the viability of the wealth tax, how it relates to land taxes, and on the estate duty, and we are looking at these recommendations. It's important to remember, honourable members, the tax amendments of the last 5 years have included some of these proposals, and we are looking at additional proposals, of course, for the 2021 budget. With respect to the take-up of the tax relief measures, firstly, let me point out there was, I think, a misreading in some of the comments that were made, particularly by the group of economists around the tax relief measures, where they seem to have confused the 70 billion rands in actual tax relief with the 26 billion rand in the direct cost to the fiscus that we outlined in the budget review. Those numbers are perfectly accurate, and there is no discrepancy between the actual economic support being provided by tax relief and the top, and the cost to the fiscus, because some of the tax relief measures do not necessarily require the fiscus to give up money. It just requires certain deferrals and other levies to be deferred over some time. So that's important to remember. This slide shows the preliminary data from SARS up until last week of what the take-up on those tax relief measures has been. I'm not going to go through all of this. You can read in your own time, because we have limited time for this presentation. But it does show that there are movements taking place. 9,000 firms are utilizing deferrals. The skills development levy exemption is providing relief. We can see applications coming in on a case-by-case basis for various relief, including from SMME vendors. These slides, Mr. Chairman, are on the economic policy issues. And I wanted my colleagues, my colleague Dr. Duncan Peterson, if you'll allow, to go through these economic policy slides for us in order to just outline the message. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, he can quickly go through that.
Yes, fine. You're at 27 minutes almost, but fine. We can give you a few more minutes beyond that. Remember, you've also got another 15 minutes after civil society response. Can I suggest, though, you should be more concrete in your responses to exactly what the stakeholders said, and less general, Duncan, please. But you could start with the overview. Duncan?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and good morning to the members. Yeah, I think what I'll do as I go through the slides is just link it back to specific issues that were raised. I think the point we want to make here is Chair and members, specifically in response to the submissions around whether additional spending can in fact lead to better growth outcomes. So quite a few of the submissions make the argument that in fact if we raise spending that can boost economic growth, and so this slide in particular speaks to that. The first point, which Edgar's already made, is that government expenditure has in fact increased from 27% of GDP in 2009 to just over 32% without the necessary response on the economic growth side. And part of the reason for that is because, of course, this additional spending has to be financed through additional debt. And what we find is that in our own work, as well as in literature from the rest of the world, is that unsustainable spending, in fact, leads to higher debt, which is associated with lower growth. So fiscal multipliers in emerging markets like ourselves are much smaller than in advanced economies. So that means that for each rand of spending by the fiscus, the impact on growth can often be close to zero or sometimes even negative. In our case, what we have found in our work is that South Africa's fiscal multipliers are very small, and they were possibly even negative before the crisis. And a negative fiscal multiplier means that additional government spending actually leads to a contraction in growth. Now, that might seem counterintuitive, but the way it works is because countries that have high debt, they can in fact have high negative multipliers, because fiscal consolidation could actually have positive credibility and confidence effects on private demand. And negative fiscal multipliers, as we said, means that spending increases can in fact contract growth. And given where our levels of debt are, we are at the point where, in fact, additional spending, because it can, because it's accompanied by large levels of debt, can in fact have a negative impact on growth, because it raises aggregate economic risks and it increases with it the cost of borrowing in the economy as a whole. One way for the honourable members to think about that is South Africa's risk premium, which is the additional return that investors demand to compensate for higher risk, has actually increased from around 3% at the end of 2019 to just over 5% now. So our investors are saying, we will buy your debt, but we are demanding much, much greater premium in order to buy it, because we are not sure whether you will be able to pay that debt back because your economic growth is so low. And what this has resulted in is this has resulted in reduced investment by the private sector, which has resulted in slower growth and less employment. Next slide, please. On the previous slide, we spoke about less investment, and here the investment story becomes a little bit clearer, because what we can see is that government spending has been on a continuous upward trajectory, so from around 10% of GDP to over 20% of GDP over the last 50 years or so. But gross fixed capital formation has in fact declined and stagnated, and then started declining again in recent years. So it's not always true that higher government spending leads to higher growth, as I said previously, because of the issues around the financing of that expenditure. And what has happened here is that the government spending has in fact overtaken investment as a share of nominal GDP, and investment has begun to decline as an overall share of GDP, following some recovery between 2000 and 2009. And I think, as the honourable members will know, the private sector actually accounts for 60% of GDP, and the remaining 40% of investment in the economy is split between government investment and the state-owned companies, mainly Transnet and Eskom. So what the state needs to be focused on, and I think this is certainly where we agree with COSATU and others, is creating the enabling environment for the private sector to be able to invest, so that 60% of contribution to investment that the private sector makes can in fact boost our growth. Next slide, please. So I think if one comes back to the issue of government spending that has increased, but investment stagnating, and remind ourselves that the private sector in fact contributes 60% of investment, with the remainder mainly coming from state-owned companies in the form of Transnet and Eskom, what that tells us is that what our debt stabilization will require is additional growth by removing some of these structural constraints to growth. And again, to come back to the inputs that were made, there were a few slides submitted by COSATU, which we absolutely agree with, around the economic interventions and those structural reforms that need to be removed in order to enable investment and employment growth. Many of these issues have been highlighted in the document that was published last year, and the government has started moving towards implementing several of those detailed structural reforms. But I thought, instead of going through them in any amount of detail, I thought I would just highlight what exactly we mean by structural constraints. So a structural constraint is simply something like the fact that at the moment it is very difficult for Eskom to provide the country with reliable and affordable electricity. So this, of course, is a structural constraint to investment. And so the structural reform in response to that is, how do we leverage our significant renewable energy resources that are also labor intensive in their production in order to, over time, enable a just transition for the electricity sector? So the constraint is affordable and reliable electricity, and the intervention or the structural reform is, how do we leverage renewable energy resources to create jobs and to lower electricity prices and to stabilize electricity supply. Just another structural constraint, which the members will be familiar with, the lowest wage workers in our economy spend 40% of their incomes on transport. And this is a structural constraint that prevents their effective participation in this economy. And so the structural reform there, of course, has to do with how do we densify our cities, how do we reverse apartheid-era spatial planning, and how do we fix our passenger rail entities. And that then has to do with how do we modernize our network industries so that we actually have a passenger rail entity that is able to allow our lowest paid workers to effectively participate in this economy. And that would be the structural reform. Next slide, please.
So, you're 35 minutes. If you could please round up, because we'll come back to you. You've got another 15 minutes when we come back. I don't want to be rigid, but our members fine to give them another few minutes. Is that okay?
Last slide, Chair. Thank you for indulgence, Chair. Last slide on my side. Just a reminder, as pointed out by Kosatu and others, these structural reforms are critical and we are in absolute agreement with them. Real GDP per capita has declined since 2015, productivity growth has slowed, and importantly, our investment growth has been negative in 12 of the last 17 quarters. And our economic growth has persistently been worse than expected since 2012. And our potential growth has also declined significantly. And that's why we believe that debt stabilization will require the unlocking of these structural reforms so that we can enable our businesses, our households, and our people to effectively participate in this economy. I've highlighted the main elements of the reform agenda there as well. I won't go through them, but the members will see that this reflects our thinking around how we think we can unlock the structural constraints in this economy and return growth to sustainable levels so that our fiscal sustainability can be restored. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So can we go to Kosatu and civil society actors, please? I think in the order they appeared. Has Kosatu got anything to say? We've got 30 minutes to share between you if you want that amount of time. So Matthew, do you want to say anything?
Sure. Just quickly comment, Chair, and thanks to the colleagues from Treasury. I think just a few quick points, Chair. Look, for us, if we criticize the budget, we're not criticizing just Treasury. We view this as a government budget. An entire government must take responsibility for the different roles. Look, we would agree with government that the debt trajectory is quite worrying. It's not hitting us so much now, but the projected increase is worrying. And we do know, as Kosatu, and we have been raising concerns about it, that if we get to the debt trap level, the first ones to suffer would be workers. It would be public servants who would have their wages slashed. It would be workers who will be retrenched, etc. But I think, Chair, our difference with government is about how to resolve it. We think the way to resolve it is to stimulate the economy, so we can grow, so we can create jobs, and then we can increase revenues to the state. That's how we'll pay down. We're very worried that if we just simply cut without stimulating the economy, we may end up choking the economy. And so we're looking at examples, Chair, from the EU, the US, China, where they've gone for the stimulus route. But so I think for us, it's about how you resolve it. Chair, I think for us, the fundamental issue is that we're in an economic recession. We already have 40% unemployment levels. We have thousands being retrenched. We might hit 50% unemployment. So it's how to grow the economy, how to create jobs. And our frustration that the only messages we got out of this budget and the February budget is that we're going to tackle the wage bill and we're going to reduce expenditure. We don't get a plan how we're going to grow the economy, how we're going to create jobs. There's not even a job creation target in the budget. Workers are being retrenched at SOEs and there's no response from the state. Chair, but we agree with government that where will the money come from? And for us, we really have hoped to hear more from government about further interventions, capacitate SAR, further measures to reprioritize expenditure.
Okay, cool. Okay, no problem. Thank you.
I think, Chair, we had hoped to hear more about tackling wasteful expenditure and corruption, more about customs enforcement. Chair, on the stimulus plan, just in the last two issues, for us that is critical. And it's not just us as Kosatu who sat somewhere and thumb-sucked. We had met with the President of the Republic several times. He had said in his own words, anything less than a $1 trillion stimulus plan is not going to cut it. It will not take us out of the recession. out of the unemployment crisis. He has spoken very eloquently about a Marshall Plan equivalent, and we didn't see that in the budget. We know you can't print money. We don't want to go the Zimbabwe route, etc. But for us, what is critical is the infrastructure program, which we support, but it needs to be prioritizing ports, rail, energy, etc. to grow the economy. We would hope to hear more about impact investments because it is critical to get domestic investment, more about job creation. And it's good that the Treasury is speaking about the regulatory reforms in the economy, and many of them have been highlighted, we all know them, but the different departments are not moving with any sense of speed. So we've been talking about digital spectrum for years, no movement. We've been talking about water licensing, no movement. So those are just examples which are blocking economic growth, and we don't understand why government is not showing the leadership to deal with it. Even on the SOEs, Chair, we have not seen clear plans to resolve them. There is some positive movement at ESCOM, which is hopeful, but we need to see much more, and see not a bigger role on the DFIs. We agree about the GPF mandate, Chair, which is critical, but we think there is a need to engage with the PIC about how they invest in ways which grow the economy, which create jobs, etc. Lastly, Chair, I think it would have been good to have seen from government a commitment to reducing what management and what politicians earn on the wage bill. If you want to get workers to compromise, they need to see people on top who have broken the state, bleeding and making the necessary sacrifices. But let me stop there, Chair, because I know the time pressures. Thank you.
Okay. C19, are they here in Kuala Lumpur? Alan? Anybody?
Yes, Chair.
Okay. Who's here?
Hi. I'm from C19.
Yeah.
And I'd just like to give... three brief points. Our intervention is mostly about asking, in terms of the grants. We're a group that focuses on the cash grants, and our main comments was that the cash grant is being cut in terms of the budget, and also that it's the total allocation is insufficient in terms of cash transfers needed in this moment of crisis. And our response to the presentation is really along three lines. The first line is just to say that while we agree that the debt is extremely important and has been worrying for many years coming, there are kind of three responses to it. One is that we were commenting from a perspective of priorities of the budget right now, and we're arguing that there should be a humanitarian kind of priority to the budget. Ultimately, of course, the only use of kind of economic growth and so on is for broader welfare grounds for the country, and we're in a very special moment right now in terms of the COVID time, where globally there needs to be a reprioritization of short-term humanitarian interventions versus longer-term interventions. And so if that does mean some kind of trade-off along the five-year horizon to plug certain deep welfare impacts in the near to this kind of 3 to 6 month horizon, that seems well justified. And all of our data to date really indicates significant and severe kind of short-term welfare effects. If we look at everything from unemployment to the levels of hunger and poverty, we've got enormous amounts of data coming in of job impacts, for example, on the level we've never seen before. The second ground is that that in terms of debt, the COVID moment does mean that the investor response to debt is different. It's kind of a unique moment which we can leverage, not only in terms of a different response from investors, but also in terms of that this is a temporary increase in debt, potentially to be funding something like grants. It also matters where the debt goes. And so that's why we're kind of arguing against these cuts to the grants, the 50 billion to 41 billion specifically. And then the third point is just want to agree with the previous comment from Matthew Parks from Kasatu that it would have been nice to see more of a sacrifice across across the board, specifically in the form of not only, as suggested by Matthew Park, but also in terms of the taxes and the burden taken on by higher income earners. We know that low income earners have taken the majority of the hit in terms of job loss, but while higher income earners have kind of retained incomes to a large degree while having very little job loss, we think that in terms of equitable COVID impact for the kind of 1 year budget for the country, there should be equitable distribution of burden, and that should include tax increase for the rich, which would also help with the budgeting problem. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul Hoffman. Yeah, do you want to say anything?
Just to quickly thank you, Chair. Morning to the committee. I'm disappointed, like Kasatu, that so little is said about the effect of grand corruption on the ability of the state to acquit itself of its responsibilities under the Constitution. We know that the spending at the moment is 62 cents in the rand on the wage bill of the state and 22 cents in the rand almost on servicing debt. This is what government has been spending money on, and a lot of the money that has been spent by government in other ways has been spent to feed the monster that we call grand corruption in South Africa. We know that grand corruption is responsible for about 1.5 trillion of state money disappearing into the pockets of the corrupt. That needs to be dealt with if we are going to avoid falling into a sovereign debt trap. We are not going to attract new investment while the investors are lacking in the confidence that the rule of law is intact in South Africa and that the culture of impunity that grew so exponentially during the Zuma years has not been brought to an end by reform, structural reform of the Criminal Justice Administration, by the introduction of the Integrity Commission, which will investigate and prosecute grand corruption, as Accountability Now has been asking for since 2012. We came to this committee with two points, the one to deal with hunger, and the other to suggest a basic income grant. Neither of those were canvassed by Treasury. Maybe they do not believe that hunger is part of their knitting, but they will be introduced to it when starving masses storm the Treasury in search for a crust of bread. We really do need to stop the wastage of edible food. One third of the food in South Africa ends up incinerated or on a landfill. Our other point in relation to the introduction of a basic income grant, I see in my legal brief this morning that Lithuli House is engaged in the feasibility of such a grant. So Treasury is going to be asked, where can the money come from for a basic income grant? And the answer is that the state needs to get proactive about raking back the 1.5 trillion that has fallen into the hands of the corrupt. You do that, you will have enough money to cope with the COVID crisis and to introduce a less inequitable and unequal society in the wake of COVID. Thank you. Those are the submissions for Accountability Now.
Thank you. It's Ota now. Is Ota here in Nkululeko?
Yes, Chair.
Quickly, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'll be very brief. I just want to say thank you to National Treasury. I think it's a very robust response. And to the members as well, I think this is the first time that we can really see clearly that there's a direct engagement with the content. So a few points that I would like to make, Chair, and the primary response I'm seeing from National Treasury is essentially a defensive one, which I can understand. But we made recommendations that are largely in line with National Treasury's plan, and we are quite happy with the intention. And just to really get into the specifics and to elaborate on the suggestion that the expansionary fiscal policy thus far has not yielded any positive results, any real growth, any improvement of people's lives on the ground. And I think it's very important, Chair, for Parliament especially, and for oversight purposes, to really ask the question why that is the case. And I agree with previous speakers that that is largely the case because of misspending, maladministration, and corruption at every level of government. So I really would like to understand whether National Treasury is engaging with other departments on their reshaping of their specific budgets, whether there is an engagement with SELGA and the likes on local government finances, and how that needs to change fundamentally. Chair, just thinking on state-owned enterprises and how these are set to change, how they're set to be restructured. What are the plans for the devolution of some of these functions to metropolitan government, thinking about Eskom no longer being the sole proprietor of energy and electricity? What are the plans in terms of budgeting going forward for metropolitan governments to purchase electricity directly from independent producers? And the same for the Competition Commission's recommendations that BRASA be unbundled and that Metro Rail be handed over to metropolitan governments. Jefferson, we strongly agree with, as I said, most of what National Treasury has mentioned, especially that there are long-run structural weaknesses in the economy that will not be addressed by more spending. We really want to get a sense of what Treasury's response is to the suggestion that expenditure could be reduced even further. We are, as an organization, very acutely aware of waste that occurs systemically in major departments, not to mention bloated compensation, aggregate compensation of public officials, but generally assets and immovable assets in particular that are not used productively. Chief, so we're very interested in the review of public-private partnership frameworks that was mentioned, and we would like to see some elaboration on that going forward and some more emphasis on that. We know that a lot of corruption has happened at the intersection between the private and public sectors. For that reason, we very much agree and support the public procurement bill. Chair, I would like to just finally request that going forward, and we do look forward to more specific and drastic changes that are going to come in October with the MTBPS, but to really understand in the meantime, when reference is made to the importance of the renewable energy sector, for example, looking at the current Department of Energy's budget and how money is not added to grid electrification with an emphasis on renewable energy, but rather that money is added to a nuclear energy agenda, is something that we are concerned about, and we would like to understand how these statements are going to be aligned with at least the interim changes to the budget. Also, Chair, we didn't really see a response to the concern we raised about the Departments of Defense and Police, which have received increased allocations for the short term, really for their expanded operations related to COVID-19. Does Treasury not believe that this needs to be reprioritized from existing budgets for those departments? And finally, Chair, just to repeat this, we very much agree that debt stabilization demands structural economic reforms. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you. BJC, are they here in Nkululeko, Budget Justice Coalition?
Yes, Chair, they are here.
Okay, please. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi, sorry, just switching on my video. I hope you can see me. Good morning, everyone. I want to respond to a few things and then I'll pass on to my colleague Daniel McLaren, who'll take on from there. I think the first and foremost important thing that we want to note here is that this package, which I don't think has adequately been responded to, does not preserve the economy right now, and it's not sufficient. I think that's the most important thing we need to discuss. Secondly, I want to respond to the idea that it's not austerity that's happening. This is a continuous argument between Treasury and civil society. And I want to note that, yes, the budget has been expanding, but the budget has been expanding for debt servicing costs. When we did calculations on the February budget, we found that there was a net cut of $48 billion to non-interest expenditure. This is just cost interest expenditure. I also want to note that there was a comment about fiscal multipliers and how the fiscal multipliers of South Africa were close to zero before the crisis. I do not agree with this comment because UNCTAD's 2019 report showed fiscal multipliers were 1.47. Even IEJ's calculations of fiscal multipliers is above one. I do not understand how, within a couple of months, we could have deteriorated from a fiscal multiplier above one to close to zero. So I'd like to see more around that evidence. As one of the Treasury people said earlier this week, that Treasury is driven by evidence, but I'm keen to see how we believe that fiscal multipliers in South Africa has deteriorated to zero. The other thing that I wanted to add is to say that we are continuously being reprimanded for wanting more spend, but to actually clarify that it's not just about more spend, it's about how are we spending that money to drive this economy. We do not want spend for the sake of wanting more spend. That's not what civil society is here to do. We are here because we acknowledge that, one, spending on poor people, on grants, has high, multipliers, because those people have higher marginal propensities to spend. And therefore, that helps our domestic markets. But also, it does protect those people's livelihoods, and it also progresses human rights. I also want to say that in terms of tax, we welcome the fact that there will be tax increases, and we hope that these will not be regressive. We hope that these will tackle high-income earners, as our research has shown that there are higher multipliers, economic multipliers, when higher-income earners are taxed over poor people. And lastly, I want to say...
We'll see, we can't hear you. Can we move over to your colleague in the meanwhile? Can people hear me?
Can hear you, sir.
Right. So where's your colleague? Can you be brief, please? We're running out of time, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chair. Yeah. Lucy covered most of the substance, I think, of our response. I just want to make a quick addition on our... to respond to the kind of tenor of the conversation that began, as well as one or two other quick notes on the substance. So I think the BJC noted what you said in the public hearing, Chairperson, that we need to approach this crisis with some degree of humility. It's unprecedented. The top scientists in the world are struggling to figure out exactly how to respond from a public health. So we're all scrambling for ideas. But what we would suggest to the BJC is that these processes, these hard-won democratic processes, they show that there is a lot of ideas on the table for our government to consider. And we shouldn't be kind of just rejecting them outright. We need a government which is receptive to these ideas, and something which BJC is always asking for, and which we've stepped up in terms of the language which we decided to use in this submission, is for more opportunities for engagement with the executive on the budget planning process, rather than just having these conversations once the Minister of Finance has tabled proposals in Parliament. We've made proposals and we'd like the Treasury to respond for how civil society stakeholders, as well as all kinds of other stakeholders, should be given a chance to engage with departments on their budget submissions, with the MTEC committees on the evaluation of those submissions, so that some of these ideas which are coming up from the ground can start to filter through in government. And secondly, this applies not just to new spending, but also on the quality of spending. Most of the BJC organizations, their fundamental perspective is actually around the quality of service delivery on the ground. So most organizations are not in community talking about austerity and deficits and debt. They're talking about how we can get communities access to water, to electricity, to housing, etc. So the BJC is fundamentally concerned with the quality of spending. We're not just calling for more spending. However, we do at the same time recognize an economic, and I'm afraid it is also a political analysis, that austerity as an approach to a fiscal crisis hasn't worked anywhere else. We don't think it will work in South Africa, and we're concerned that the Treasury is a little bit too blind to the impact of budget cuts on poverty, on inequality, on unemployment, and the language of short-term harm that we're hearing from the Treasury. It actually underplays the extent of the damage of these policies, and that's our fundamental argument. So we want more engagement on the substance, and we want more opportunities to get closer together.
Okay. Thanks, Daniel.
Throughout these issues. Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, the fiscal study group, are they here?
Yes, Jeff.
Okay, very quickly.
So thank you, Chair, and thank you to Treasury for their response. Just one from our view, we focus.
People, please mute their audio. It could let me help. Go ahead, Daniel.
Thank you, Chair. So just in general, our focus is very strongly on fiscal sustainability. One thing that we also see from the Treasury's review now is the problem with a structural low economic growth that we have been experiencing in South Africa, and for us especially that the serious impact that it has on state revenue. For us, there should be a stronger focus on the revenue side, as that is the limiting factor in all of these discussions. A lot of the discussions focus more on the expenditures, whereas we think that the revenue side is very important. One example is that something like 600,000 individual taxpayers are now contributing almost 20% of government's revenue. So that is scary figures. Just again, we want to also, we like to point about the fact that there was no austerity in the budget for at least the last decade. In fact, the fiscal stance has been very expansionary. Then we also take note of the negative fiscal multiplier, which is a scary place to be at. And again, showing the limited fiscal space or ability of the fiscal side of the economy to stimulate this whole process, and that we really need the old saying of we need to get economic growth going. And then just lastly, as you know, we've been looking especially at items like civil service remuneration, social assistance payments, and debt service costs. And just to make the point that we have now reached a point where those three items alone will absorb 100% of government revenue for this year. Thank you.
Hi, Chair. Mr. Karim.
Kululek.
Chair.
Who's next online to present?
It was Economist Initiative, but I don't see them online. I'm not too sure if they are here.
Economist Initiative, are you there?
I don't think they are here, Chair. Then the next one is Saika.
Saika, can you...
Yes, thank you very much. I'd just like to comment on two things on the presentation. He mentioned that there's a 24% tax to GDP ratio, so I didn't know if I heard correctly or if that's correct, because it doesn't seem to match up with the figures that we've got. And he also said that that the pay as you earn, and that's maybe directed more towards SARS, but that there are pay as you earn deferrals that seem to have declined from April to May. So I'm not sure what has happened there, because, I mean, COVID hasn't gone away, so we're uncertain why those defined the benefits, the tax benefits provided, are reducing, are being used by less people rather than more, or just the same, which is a good thing, but we'd just like more clarity on that. And as many other speakers have mentioned so far, on the expenditure side, and I think it's a major issue. It's not how we spend, or it's not how much we're spending, but what are we spending it on, and what is the quality of our spend. We cannot have another Auditor General report released like it was on Wednesday with the municipalities, the irregular expenditure carrying on year, nothing seeming to be changed, nothing is being done about it, and that links me to accountability. Again, there is no accountability. We do need a unified government, and if National Treasury did say that it was Casata's view that we need a private sector-led investment to stimulate the economy, we support that, and we'd like to see more activities from the private sector growing and creating jobs, not just investing, that they need to be part of the economy. Getting back to the expenditure side, there's certain expenditure that hasn't been mentioned in the budget. You know, we've mentioned these before, the bailouts for state-owned entities, the failing infrastructure on water and sewage. Where are these things coming through on the infrastructure spend? We can't see that at the moment. The unsustainable wage rates, they just cannot carry on. No change in that. We know we're at the bargaining council, but we need accountability there as well. And this is shown in the Auditor General's report. We cannot keep spending money where there is no service delivery and no accountability when there is no service delivery. The other thing I want to highlight is with the Government Employee Pension Fund that was brought out about a funding initiative. Can we use those funds? Well, we need to point out that's a defined benefit contribution plan that is guaranteed by taxpayers. So taxpayers will be funding any shortfall resulting from those investments, and it shouldn't be reliant or subject to investment risk. So at this stage, it is underfunded, it's falling short, the investment is going to come down, and taxpayers are going to have to fund those differences. That has not been accounted for in the budget at this stage. And the other thing is that the guarantees that we are providing there, we need to re-look at those. We cannot carry on in that regard. The National Treasury mentioned this is a crisis, a short-term crisis.
Sharon, can you please summarize?
Yeah, so please, we need accountability. We need to look at expenditure. Our revenue estimates are critical. At this stage, they seem unrealistic, and that determines our expenditure. So if we don't get that right, our expenditure will be excessive, and we need to cut down on our expenditure and have accountability for the expenditure that is not spent properly. Thank you.
Thanks. Honorable Karim, are you back? Okay, let's proceed. Nkululeko Nalan, who's the next to respond?
It was Mr. Peter Mieken.
Mr. Mieken, it's your time now. Can you take 2 minutes and make an input?
Yes, I could certainly. I'd be very interested to do. I'm glad I've finally got to speak to you, because something's got to be done here, sir. That something's really missing. 2 years ago, the present Minister of Finance said that income taxes have got to be replaced by land taxes. Was there qualification to that of any importance? Now, not once has anybody from Treasury referred to that fact. And I do think that as your committee must find out what's going on here. Either that's wrong, and therefore we shouldn't go any further. But if it is wrong, why was that made? You see, they said in the MTBPS of 2018, they said income taxes and VAT are inefficient. No, that's enough to suggest that somebody should look at it. That. And I have had no response to my calculation that means that the cost of living of the average South African family is not has increased through income taxes and VAT by 70,000 rand per annum. No, there's nothing. There's no response to that. And Mr. Chairman, I must leave you, please, to find out what's going on. Many thanks.
Thanks, thank you very much. Kulla Golan, who's next to respond?
Chair, that concludes the ones that presented. There is a Dr. Greenberg from a civil society that would like to comment. He only made written submissions to the committees.
Make a 2 minutes comment.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so thanks for the opportunity. Look, I'm representing more than 40 civil society organizations in the land and agriculture sector. So just to cut it very simple, we are asking the question why the defense and police budgets have been increased by over 5 billion rand and the agriculture fisheries budgets have been cut by more than 3 billion rand in total, specifically targeted at local food security, land reform, local programs for people to produce food. So we don't understand why there's more money going to policing and more money going to short-term things like social grants rather than to productive activity and supporting productive activity, and we're calling for a return of that money so that people can actually become part of the economy as discussed in the reform, the last 2 points in the reform agenda of the department. It's not calling for increased expenditure or anything. It's calling for a return of the money from militarization and policing towards agriculture and food security support. That's all.
Thanks very much. The last among the stakeholders.
Yes, Chair. There's nobody else to my knowledge.
I've got PBO Chair. They would like to respond as well.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Can PBO proceed, Chair?
Yes. 3 minutes, please, Doctor.
Okay. Both myself and my colleague, Dumasani Yankis, are going to respond. I will just respond to some of the points very quickly. And the first point I'd like to make in response to especially the DG said, was that, you know, there are lots of ways to interpret data and to present other people's views as not fact-based and more as fact-based when people are, lots of different people doing empirical work and taking this real seriously is not correct. We are basically arguing for different interpretations of the truth and different views about the truth and also different approaches to economics. And so I'd like to respond to 2 points that especially made by Duncan Peterson. And one of the things that we've been saying, and we said it in the MTBPS and we said it before, is that the approach that National Treasury has taken is based on a certain kind of economics view. And one of this is about that high debt leads to lower growth. And there's no support in the economics literature for this. I don't know which studies Duncan is referring to. The work of Reinhardt, where they showed over 90% debt to GDP may start having a small negative impact on GDP growth. Other than that, the work that has come out afterwards responding to Reinhardt and Rogoff has actually shown that even over 100%, you still get a positive impact on GDP growth from debt. The association and the relationship. The second is that their view is based on something called contraction expansion. Basically, if government doesn't spend money and they bring things under control, irrespective of the damage that causes in the economy, the possibility of negative multipliers bringing down GDP, if you increase business confidence, you may get the private sector to invest more. And that study by Alessina and Adania 2009 was found even by the IMF to be empirically wanting. They found that the data was misrepresenting when you had fiscal expansions and fiscal contractions. And so from the economics perspective, that argument really needs to be rethought. And I thought that the BJC people responded to the point about negative multipliers in South Africa really well. And I think I would concur with their view that your multipliers depend on where you spend the money and how effectively it's spent. And in this kind of downturn, if you're providing money to businesses that may go out of business and lose employers, and to poor people who are struggling to put food on their tables and to keep their families going, those were huge multipliers, and we should seriously consider that. And so the last point I want to make before I hand over to Dumisani is actually, sorry, Chair, I think I've taken enough time. Let me hand over to Dumisani and be fair to my colleagues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Siraj. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, colleagues from Treasury. I think, Chair, what I wanted to respond to was just the approach issue of the office. I think what we have chosen to do as an office over the years is that we don't necessarily want to engage in a confrontational engagement with government in many regards. And I think what has happened over the past 2 or 3 years, we have been agreeing tacitly with Treasury and that we should engage on these issues a lot offline. And I think the DG will remember that we have actually been talking about engaging on these things in the recently, say, let's meet, whereby we engage on these things. So largely some of these things are contested, as my colleagues have emphasized there. I think we still committed to that discussion offline, not really in a confrontational engagement. I think on our approach, Chair and all members, we certainly were established to support the committees in processing these money bills and related matters from government in a way so far as we don't necessarily, I mean, our approach is largely reliant on data, what has evidence of data is, what data is out there, what information is out there, and we present our analysis based on that information. And some of these issues we've raised here, we've raised them long, like Siraj said, we've been raising over the years, and it's not anything new in terms of what how level of inequality, level of poverty, level of students, and how much has been the government response in that regard. And I think it's important for us then, Chair, that these engagements are taken on in that sense, and it doesn't, you know, we don't get so confrontational because at the same time we lose the importance of having debates that are more fruitful for value add for the public finance, for government, or for economy as a whole. I think the issue that I wanted to comment, I think Siraj touched on the issue of the debt. I think the point I wanted to touch on it because I've one of the papers that I've also seen there, Reinhardt and Rogoff, which largely argued about the debate around macroeconomic debt levels and macroeconomics, where, you know, obviously it borders around argument that there is ultimate debt level within microeconomics, which certainly has not been able to prove that. And I think there was a paper that was sort of trying to critique that paper, shows that actually more growth is more important, because when you have more growth, obviously the ratio becomes more thinner. And because, I mean, the debt should be the ratio is based on the growth and two variables, growth and debt. And the more the economy expands, the more the ratio becomes quite thin in that regard. So the point I wanted to say in this is that we should be careful of, you know, emphasizing the assumptions that there is optimal debt level in macroeconomics, which has not really been proven in this regard. The second point is on expenditure. When you look at the post global financial crisis situation on countries that have grown and those that have grown over the years, you realize that the government spending has always been important. But I think I agree with the colleagues who have emphasized the issue of around quality of expenditure. Because when you look at Greece and Italy in particular, government has spent, but because of the quality of spending, has not realized growth than any fellow EU countries there. And some of the key areas really that you've seen spending being emphasized on, of course, efficiency of spending is a very important thing here. But also investment around infrastructure, investment around investing in research innovation, very importantly, also this investment around technology and human capital formations has seen to be some of the areas that has led to more growth than other KwaZulu, those who have invested a lot of money spending in non-growth or growth areas in that regard. Chair, I just wanted to leave. I wanted to emphasize the issue of approach and also the fact that we're still open to engage with government in some of this, not necessarily in a confidential issue. Thank you so much, Chair.
Okay. Who's next? Is it FFC? Alan and Gulek, are FFC commissioners here?
Yes, Chair. I think Henry from the FFC did log in. I'm not sure if any of the commissioners are here. Can I also just request the person that took control of the screen, please hand it back to us. Thank you.
Okay. It doesn't look like FFC is here.
Chair?
Yes.
I think in terms of the program, we're supposed to give...
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm exiting now because it's your turn to chair. I just want to remind you that actually we're pretty squeezed on time. National Treasury took close to 40 minutes and then civil society also. I think maybe what we should do is compromise, Comrade Chair, and give National Treasury a few minutes to respond now. Let the members come in and then Treasury comes in at the end and responds to everybody. But I'll leave it to you now because it's your turn to chair. Thanks.
I will suggest, Chairperson, that we leave the program as it is. This is our meeting. We should come at the end. I think
okay.
They should...
Okay, yes. Whatever. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Let them come now and try to be as short as possible. Then we have members commenting. Can we move to the next item? Thanks very much, Honorable Karim, for handing over to me, Co-Chair. Can we move now to Treasury, National Treasury's responses? 15 minutes, I think it's too long for you to respond. Can you try to cut it short? Over to you, Treasury.
Thank you, Chairperson, Honorable Members. This is Mampo Modisa speaking, and I'll just be addressing the few questions that we received in terms of spending reductions and spending proposals and reprioritizations. So basically, Chairperson and Honorable Members, when we were doing this, the first thing that we looked at was what was announced by the President. And what was announced basically was that we will need to reprioritize 130 billion to fund the spending that was announced. So basically what we have done is that initially there were only four departments that we identified as frontline services. That was health, social development, and the defense force. When we went through with the departments to reprioritize funding, we realized that just because they were not mentioned, it doesn't mean they don't have spending pressures. So when we looked for example, departments such as correctional services, for people who are not adhering to the regulations, it means there was pressure there. So we had to reprioritize from what they would have saved initially because of COVID towards what they need to do to deal with COVID. For example, quarantine sites in the prisons, we had to look at all of that. You have departments such as basic education where what we have identified is infrastructure grants, not because they are not important, but purely because if the economy is on lockdown, there was no one who was constructing any sites. So basically, we had to look at how much will the departments be able to save for the rest of the year, and we will remove the money, we will reallocate the funding that we think won't be spent for specific program. So in the supplementary budget, we have detailed explanations and amounts of reallocation per department that we will have to come back to the Standing Committee on Appropriations to represent. So basically in basic education, whatever amount we've identified, we also have to look at how much do they need to sanitize the schools, how much do they need to get ready for schools to reopen, and most of that money was reprioritized back to the department. And then you have departments as the economic growth related departments, where you're looking at small business, tourism, trade, agriculture, environmental affairs, and these departments will start kicking in, or they will start working properly in phase three of where we're looking at, because the president announced phase one, where it was the response, phase two, it was making sure that we deal with the vulnerable, and phase three would be how do we kickstart growth. So those departments' budgets will have to relook at them when we in phase three of dealing with the pandemic. Then what we also had to look at was basically how do we ensure that departments remain functional. And what we had to do was to make sure that we don't reduce funding that is allocated for non-discretionary items such as your rent, such as the functioning of a department. So most of the reductions that we have will not affect the functioning of the department. And Chairperson and Honorable Members, there was a lot of comments regarding the social grants and the fact that Treasury has reduced the budget allocated to social grants, and therefore we're not adhering to what the president has announced. As the Treasury, you always have to look at the numbers. We have been working with social development where we ask them, how are the numbers looking like? Who are the people that qualify in the different criteria? So for example, in terms of the SDR grant, the 350, there were 7 million people who applied, and only half of those, 10%.
You are requested to switch on your video, because this meeting is being recorded on YouTube and other platforms, so they want to see the faces of the participants. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just saying that when we present a budget, we have to look at the numbers. So the reduction in the allocation to development does not mean we're paying less people because we allocated less. Basically, given the trend, given the criteria, we think that social development will still deliver the mandate that was announced by the president, but in lesser amount compared to what was announced. So basically, just in terms of spending, what we're going to do next was announced by the minister is that we're going to look at spending reviews and attempts to get to a place where we talk about zero-based budgeting. So the spending reviews will be a starting point for us to get there. So we take cognizant of the fact that most of the government spending is non-discretionary, but the spending reviews will help us not only save if they're saving, but also to come up with different ways to effectively improve the way we do spending in government. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks. Are you the only one responding from Treasury, or someone else will also come? If so,
yes, there are more. There's two more colleagues to respond.
Okay, can they come in quickly? We're running out of time.
Shall I start with tax? Okay, Lisa, do you want to start?
No, you go through. I'll come after you. Just putting our technology here.
Okay, thanks, Tabitha. Good morning, members. Good morning, chairs. There were just a couple of questions on tax. I think the one was on the tax to GDP. I think they were referring to 26.4%, not 24, but yeah, 26.4% going down to 23% in the supplementary budget. You know, why is the number of firms declining in May after April for the paid year-end deferral? We can check with SARS on that data. It is preliminary data that's just come in. Maybe there's some of the firms haven't shown up. Just on the revenue estimates, which seem unrealistic, again, I think it's page 34 of the supplementary review that you could just go and have a look at. We've got a big drop in tax to GDP, but the tax to GDP going forward does track quite closely the global financial crisis, and we think it is a reasonable. There was the point on from Mr. Meeson on land tax and why has nothing been done. We did publish a slide in response to the same submission 2 years ago. I mean, just to read the slide quickly that we did respond, we didn't agree to get rid of income taxes and replace with the land tax. It was just saying that National Treasury recognizes the potential improvements in efficiency from land taxes as highlighted by the OECD and their report, Taxation and Economic Growth. But we did say, however, the Davis Tax Committee had done some work on this, and they'd raised some what we thought were valid concerns about it moving to a full land use tax instead of income taxes, that it may create a less diversified tax base, there are cash flow issues, and it may lead to some high income individuals facing lower tax charges. So it has been something that we've been thinking about, and we do get a lot of proposals on different tax structures each year, but we can't obviously go ahead with all of them. So it is still one of those that we do look at. That's everything from my side. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris, and good morning to Parliament and honourable members. There was a question about borrowing and also utilising the national revenue cash balances. Why not do that? Why do we need to go to the IFIs or the international financial institutions to consider financing of government? I think very clear in the budget, we do stipulate how we are funding this budget deficit, and it is delineated through, you know, local funding, international funding, and it also utilizes the cash that we have. And unfortunately, we cannot run down the cash such that we are not able to operate. You need to have a positive cash balance, honorable members, and that is what we are safeguarding. So we are using all that to respond to the shock. And it's very important that there is no one at this point in time who's expecting a country not to be increasing their level of debt. That is an expected response to the shock, and all the resources that we are tapping into reflect exactly that. I think the challenge, honorable members, is if we think even over the medium term, we can continue spending the way we are. And we are not certainly saying borrowing is bad, but we are saying unproductive borrowing is bad because it is not coming back in terms of stimulating investment. It's not coming back through revenue increases and therefore the ability for government to be able to repay. As we speak right now, it would be amiss if we do not disclose the fact that the primary deficit means that we do not generate enough revenue, one, to service non-interest expenditure, two, to even service interest expenditure. And that means that every time there is a budget deficit, there is a budget deficit plus the redemptions that needs to be paid back. And that is something that is not normally very clear, because what it says is that Sepiso will borrow for the budget deficit of the main budget, but I'm also borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. And that is not sustainable. It means we are not in control. And if we do not acknowledge that, certainly what my colleagues have already alluded to in the form of a sovereign debt crisis is a reality. And the question that honorable members are going to ask us at that point in time would be, where was Treasury when this thing was happening? And I just want to caution that if, you know, history should note that these things are real, they've happened to many countries, and we can see that if we do not do the right things around how we finance and how we manage our debt, we are going to find ourselves in a very difficult situation. Our strategy has changed. We have not been borrowing from multilaterals. Most of their funding is very project-based, and as you know, we fund a national revenue fund that is not really segregated in projects. And for the first time now, they are making resources available. And some of these resources are once-off. There is no certainty that the $7 billion US dollars that we are looking to raise from multilaterals will continue in the outer years. It's very clear that it is for a specific purpose to respond to COVID and ensure that we are able to finance all the objectives that we have stated, and including the package that the president has announced. The savings of this country, honorable members, they are there to be seen. They are very meager. We are talking about approximately 4.5% of gross saving rate. And at the level at which this funding is increasing, it is certainly is eating up on that portion that is available. International investors as well have sold quite a lot since the downgrades have happened. And people would say, but why worry about downgrades? We are already junk. As you know, honorable members, even in junk, there are various levels. And the lower you go,
the higher risk premium that you pay to be able to save this this debt. So it is absolutely important that we reflect on that, and we are able to, in a very responsible way, manage the cash balances of government. It will be an unfortunate day where we have to ration cash because we are, as a government, running negative cash balances, and because there's no understanding that resources are not infinite, but there are finite level of resources that would need to be deployed. And we certainly are in favor of deploying this cash to productive sectors so that it comes back in the form of increased revenue at a particular point in time. And these are not coming at a cheap rate. And maybe just to step off a little bit and deal with the reforms, which is another question that was asked. There's nothing, I think reforms are long-term in nature, and in the supplementary budget, we might not have delved too much into the reforms, but reforms have been outlined at every budget. Every shareholder department of a state-owned company knows the kind of reforms that have been done. And these entities that we're talking about, most of them were allocated a whopping almost 129.2 billion at the time of the budget over the MTEF. And if we just consider how much they have received, it's a table in the budget from 2008-09 to now, we are looking at about 291 billion rand. So entities that have been reliant on the state and have not addressed their issues as fast as possible, unfortunately, they are now crowding out entities that are genuinely impacted by COVID and should be supported by the government given the role that they play. So these entities, the plans are there. They need to be implemented. The ones that need to be reduced, merging of state-owned companies, incorporating certain functions into government, looking at private sector participation, all that is done. And I think what we need to be asking is not the reform, but the implementation and placing accountability where it should be in relation to ensuring that these entities do not continue to be reliant on the fiscus, but are able to deliver on infrastructure, are able to deliver on the mandate that has been given to them. It is important that as we also creating new critical ones where there's a need, because these models have changed, these models have been done at a time where things were different. And I think that that conversation, similar to economic reform, needs to be placed and centered at the right place, and state agencies needs to follow through to ensure that these entities play the role that they were envisaged to play. Chairperson, I will stop there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chairperson. Are we done with Treasury's responses so that we can move to the next item of members making comments?
Chair, I've been asked just to come in quickly on the fiscal multipliers, if you'll allow me. I'll be a minute.
Okay. You can make a comment.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Just to respond to the issue of fiscal multipliers, which have been raised a few times now, I think, Chair, it's clear that none of us really know what the fiscal multipliers are now during the pandemic. What we do, however, know is that if we don't take account of debt dynamics in our assessment,
hello, Duncan, we are losing you.
I think it's network on his side, Chair.
Can anybody from Treasury expatiate on the issue that he wanted to talk about so that I can move to the next item?
Apologies, Chair. It looks like I was kicked out of the meeting. May I continue?
No, nobody kicked you out. It is your problem.
Yes.
We don't pull out unceremoniously. Yeah.
No, thank you, Chair.
Duncan, for 1 minute.
No, thank you, Chair. As I was saying, we don't know what the fiscal multipliers are at the moment because of the pandemic. What we do know is that
Chair, with your permission, can I request Wipuso to come in? Because Duncan seems to challenge us. Wipuso, please.
Okay, quickly, 1 minute, Wipuso.
Thank you, Chair. I think what Duncan was going to refer to is some of the literature available on it, which feels like
No, just quickly, Chair. What I was saying was that the paper referred to by Busi, done by the IE.
DJ, Tanti, where is
it? It's not working.
Oh, connectivity.
Chair, Duncan will stop. Wipuso, just take over. Duncan has got serious challenges there.
Wipuso, 1 minute, please. We are running out of time. Members have to make comments, and they will have to take an hour.
I think just briefly to say that the literature that I think Duncan is referring to is showing that there are lower fiscal multipliers in this environment. What we can do, though, to give Duncan an opportunity to expand on the point he was going to make, because I'm not sure what it is at this point, would respond in writing to the comments at a later point. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's now.
Chair, if I may just come in. Chair, if I may come in, Momo.
Mom, where were you all at home?
I'm around. I've been here in this discussion. Chair, I want to make the last point.
Please, just 1 minute.
Just a point that's been made, I think, on the proceeds of corruption. I think, let me make just the point. National Treasury is totally committed to fighting corruption and to recovering funds from corruption. However, to recover funds, we then have to go through a long legal process normally. And those who have stolen tend to have pushed the money out to other accounts, etc. So it's quite a complex process. It requires the criminal justice system and everybody else to work with us. And to the extent that there is a recovery which we want to recover every cent. The point is that that's a stock. It can be used for, you know, once-off investment or something like expenditure, but it's not a flow. In other words, it can't be used every year to fund specific programs. But here, I would say at some point, it would be worth having a discussion on corruption and how to recover the proceeds of funds that have been stolen. I'll stop there, Chair.
Thanks, Momo. Is the Deputy Minister here? DJ?
No, the Deputy Minister is not on the call, Chair.
So we are done with the Treasury responses, I hope. Thanks very much, DJ and your team, for those responses. Let's move now to item 5, committee members' comments. Alan and Kululek, can you assist me with the members who want to make comments?
Chair, Dorothy Mabilesa raised the hand earlier, and then there's Dion George. That's fine.
Honorable Mabilesa.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Just a comment. Definitely, despite the difficult days we find ourselves in and challenges, we have a duty to make sure that the finances of the country are in a healthy. We also need to make sure that there are services in our country. We know we are facing challenges, but the bottom line is there should be services in our country. And we also have, we need to make sure that we build domestic productive capacity, investment in SMEs. Job creation must be done. So we can sit here and listen, you know, that we've got challenges, we've got that. But the bottom line is when I go out of the door now to the street, their services must be there. People will be asking me, you know, where is electricity? Where is water? So whatever we are sitting here and discussing, we really need to have that. Otherwise, it's just a talk show, report back, comments, and that. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Mavila, Honorable George.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm very pleased to see that there is no plan to use the GEPF members' money for suboptimal investments. I mean, obviously, as was pointed out, that it is underwritten by the taxpayer in any event. I certainly want to get some clarity also that this would also apply to private pensions, so all the other pension funds as well, that they wouldn't actually be forced into prescription and investing in suboptimal investments. And then on the tax, I agree absolutely. There's no space for additional tax to be levied on the already suffering population. But I think what Treasury has also been quite silent on, I'm sure we'll see this maybe in October and February then, is that what tax relief are people going to get who are forced to work from home, especially claiming for home offices? Because obviously the criteria that are currently in place don't work. But if they're forced to be at home, then there should be some kind of support for them. So that's a conversation that needs to be had. And then also finally, Treasury is completely silent on assisting private members on pension funds to actually have some kind of access to their pensions. Now, obviously, as was discussed yesterday and also raised by Kasatu, was that there is no intention for a whole-scale cannibalization of pensions for people, but obviously they need to make provision for retirement. But the key point is that instead of government asking how it can access people's pensions for its infrastructure development, should be asking how is it going to help individual members now who have very big difficulties to be able to access some part of their pension. So, for example, a pension-backed loan broader than just housing would go a long way to assist. So if government has no appetite, for example, for withdrawal, it can provide relief, and there's absolutely zero on that, and that is very disappointing. So I'd like to hear from Treasury, what actually are they doing regarding that? There's no reason why there can't be pension-backed loans wider than home loans, especially during this emergency. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Dr. George. Honourable Shibambu.
No, thanks, Chairperson. I think the first thing that we must do is to condemn and disassociate ourselves from the approach taken by the DG when he opened this discussion. An aggressive and an extremely intolerant approach, which is reflective of the current Minister of Finance, who does not want to receive criticism that are coming from rural civil society. That is unacceptable. We do not appreciate such kind of mannerisms. It's unacceptable. And we must say so because Parliament must be having maximal freedom to engage on whatever issue, whether we disagree or agree with National Treasury. It cannot just be those that agree with you. That must be tolerated and everything else. And if there's structural inaccuracies, you must then be able to point to that without taking an aggressive and intolerant approach that they've adopted. It's unacceptable. It must never happen again in terms of what happens. And there is genuinely concern in terms of this 500 billion because the manner in which it is being presented in the public discourse, it's as if the 500 billion is a fiscal injection from National Treasury to deal with COVID-19. It's a variety of measures which include the UIF monies which workers have deposited for conditions such as these. It's debt guarantees and a variety of other measures. It's tax deferment. It's not 500 billion fiscal injection that is going to help the economy and create jobs thereafter. So that is one issue that, of course, must be highlighted and be exposed whenever we're dealing with all of these issues. And the second issue, Chair, is that it's now apparent that National Treasury's adoption of austerity measures is just an ideological orthodox approach. There's no sound scientific and economic basis
why they choose that formula, that if you reduce expenditure, you are then going to be able to meet your debt obligations. That is not the case, because once government shrinks its expenditure, it's going to shrink the economy as well. It is like that, and the debt-to-GDP ratio is going to increase because the economy should have shrunk in the manner that it is. So there is not yet a believable and cogent presentation on why National Treasury is giving us a austerity measure. And already we have the GPF exposed to government and parastatal bonds. The discussion that we must be having now is what the current PIC board had considered of converting some of these bonds into equity, particularly in major parastatals like Eskom. I think that is one issue that must be looked into, so that there is a much more impactful and meaningful participation of workers in our country's infrastructure and economic activity. That is one issue that must be looking into. But one thing that is clear, finally, Chair, is that National Treasury has not given us a clear and believable plan now in terms of how it's going to utilize the fiscus to stimulate economic activity in South Africa. They are now getting deeper into orthodox methods of how the fiscus should be handled, but in terms of how the economy should be stimulated, there's nothing believable that they've presented. And this is not because of COVID-19. So there have been failures. Like, it is now the third quarter of consistent recession, which enough negative growth, and there is no clear plan in terms of how are they going to grow the economy, how are they going to save the economy from a continuous negative decline in the manner that it is. And it looks like even in terms of the measure of the institutions which otherwise would agree with their orthodox approaches, they are not doing well because all the rating agencies are downgrading them. So there is generally directionlessness that defines the current National Treasury leadership and philosophy in the manner that it is. And I would think that we must consider some of the proposals that came from the Economist Initiative and the Budget Justice Coalition. And even perhaps as the committee think of not accepting some of the proposals that were brought by Mr. Tito Mboweni when he presented this adjustment budget. That is my submission, Chair, but we must be intolerant attitudes and mannerisms that are being presented by National Treasury. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Shpambu. Honorable Hill Lewis.
Thanks very much, Chairperson. I'm going to disagree strongly with the previous speakers. I didn't think there was anything wrong with what the Director General did in his opening gambit. This is not some tea party or polite book club. This is Parliament, and we have freedom of speech here. And no one is entitled to any more deference or respect than the next person. And if presenters are allowed to become and be very robust with the National Treasury, then the National Treasury is more than welcome to come and defend their position and be robust in return. I thought the DG defended his position strongly, but he certainly was not rude or insulting, and was actually quite reasonable. So I just don't agree with that. And I'm also not going to take lectures on manners and politeness from the EFF. The second thing is that, let me just get to my list of questions. If the Treasury is going to be robust with us, that's fine, but then they must also take it. They said that we are rejecting the active scenario. The one Treasury speaker said that. We are not rejecting the active scenario. In fact, what we were saying was that we sincerely hope that the active scenario is realized, but we question the likelihood of it being realized given the policy paralysis in government. There's been absolutely no progress on fundamental structural reform to speak of. You can speak of minor progress in visa amendments and so on, but really the fundamental reforms around energy, and the other major reforms contained in the Treasury's document, there's been no progress on that, none to speak of. So I really question the credibility of the active scenario. I'm not projecting it. I question the credibility of whether it's going to happen or not. Then I want to come back to the point. Treasury keeps raising this issue of fiscal buffers. And let me say again, it is you, National Treasury, who is responsible for South Africa's fiscal buffers. So please don't tell the committee that there's been a failure to preserve fiscal buffers as if you don't have any agency in that problem, that it's a problem external to yourselves. If you carry primary responsibility for fiscal buffers, then make sure that they are maintained, please. I'm going to repeat this commitment in every time that you appear before our committee from now until 2023. The minister committed, the cabinet committed to fiscal balance, primary balance, by fiscal year 2023. That is a commitment that he has made explicitly to the country, and he repeated it last week to this committee. And we are going to hold you to that. That is your primary delivery KPI now, is primary balance by fiscal year 2023. And I'm going to remind you of it, and you will not be allowed to escape that commitment because you've made it. I would just say I really like the slide that you presented on state-owned entities and agree with most of the advice contained therein. You have said that you will not fund South African Airways and that Alex Corps should also be closed down, and that is, I'm pleased that you've made that commitment, and certainly we as a committee should hold you to that as well. There should be no additional funding for SAA and Alex Corps and others. Then just a brief comment in response to the Budget Justice Coalition. They have accused the National Treasury of being blind to poverty. I really think that is an unfair statement. I think every single one of us is deeply concerned about the effect of the rising cost of debt services in squeezing out spending on basic services for the poor, which exacerbates poverty. In fact, that's the whole point that the National Treasury has made over the last few days, is that rising debt costs are crowding out expenditure on the poor. So I don't think that you can accuse that of being blind to poverty. In fact, that's the very opposite of the point that they have made. And I do just want to say a very big thank you to the National Treasury. I think it's really an appalling thing that you have come here and you know tried your very best to chart a course of fiscal sustainability for the country, to avert a debt crisis, when really very few other people in your own government are listening to you. Let's be honest, that's the truth. But you are trying anyway, and doing an exceptionally good job, and to be rounded on with a lot of dishonest statements and then saying that you can't defend yourself, I think that's just not appropriate, and I don't associate myself with those views. And I say strength to your arm, and every South African should sleep slightly better at night knowing that there are a small group of people fighting the good fight to avoid a sovereign debt crisis in this country. Thank you.
No, you will come after Honorable Ryder, Honorable Abrams. It is you, Honorable Abrams, then Murolong, and then Honorable Yunis Karim. Honorable Ryder.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Yes, I want to agree strongly with Mr. Hill-Lewis. I think that Treasury has put together a good presentation, and I want to agree with large parts of it. I am pleased to see that there's a kind of a move away from the prescribed assets thing, but as Dr. George said, you know, if we can get an indication if this has only got to do with the GEPF or if it's a general movement away from that.
I did think that there were a couple of issues that the presentation didn't really address in terms of some of the inputs, and I just want to maybe get some more inputs on it. And I think that one of the comments was that came out of the engagements was that the president has reneged on his promises of relief. I don't believe that there was enough information to counter that. I think perhaps Dr. Mokgojane may have touched on it slightly, but I think the presentation itself didn't really give us a lot of comfort that concern had been adequately addressed by Treasury. So if we can have some comment on the fact that the relief promises are actually valid and will be taken into account. Then, which I think may have been aimed at addressing the issue of zero-based budgeting. And there was a lot said about zero-based budgeting the other day by many of the presenters on Wednesday and on Tuesday as well. And the fact is that I don't think we've addressed the concerns properly. Certainly you haven't addressed my concerns properly. And to pick on one of the matters, the Defense Department, as an example, and I understand this is going to be taken through in appropriations, but it points to the theory behind it and the principles of the framework. The defense budget already has an unfunded organigram. They have consistently got qualified audits because they're overspending on staff, they're overspending their budget, but they don't have a way out. And they've apparently consulted with Treasury. They don't have a way out of getting out of their unfunded organigram. So we note the fact that I think there's been an increase of 2.8 billion rand that's gone to the Defense Department. But we also note that the President's letters of 21 April added 4.5 billion rand of expenses to the Defense Department in terms of their current deployment. There was a letter out last night again, although we've only seen it in the press, we haven't seen it anywhere else yet, but that the Army's employment will actually be extended and there's going to be another billion rand cost. So that's going to give the Defense Department, call it 6 billion rand against, call it 3 billion rand, that 6 billion rand's worth of expenses against 3 billion rand of money that's being given to them additionally. So there's a genuine concern that zero-based budgeting is not actually being taken seriously, it's not following through, and I really think we need to go back and have a look at how these things can be addressed, because so much of the departmental expenses relate back to salaries, not only for the Defense Department, for many departments, and how will we achieve zero-based budgeting in the short term? Chair, I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honourable Ryder. Honourable Abraham.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Let me just make three pointers. The first one is around infrastructure development. I think if we want to talk economic growth, we have to, a certain extent, talk to issues of infrastructure development. And I think as Treasury, we need to talk to that and be able to say which areas are we targeting for that. And secondly, Chair, there's an issue on the Solidarity Fund, and one is interested to know whether Treasury is involved in the Solidarity Fund. If not, who is? Because we need to know as the committee what are the accountability parameters, because we do not want to shout corruption without base. We need to know where is it accounted for. Lastly, Chair, for me, the issue of the Treasury having answered very well is true, and that's exactly the reason why the DG didn't have to make such harsh comments at the beginning. We are not talking issues of capacity here. We're talking issues of attitude. It is not government alone who has a responsibility to grow the economy of this country. Rather, business, community, as well as labor, all of us are involved in ensuring the growth of the economy in our country. And therefore, there should be no intimidation of one by the other in the process of doing that. So I think the DG went a bit overboard, and I think he needs to correct that, because the comments, the way they are, they had a scathing impact even on the committee members themselves. So I think that's why we're saying it cannot be on, it cannot be allowed. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Abraham, for your comments. Honorable Murolong from SwaziRainet.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson. Just one question. Much of the UIF reserves are tied up in the government bonds. Is this a way for the South African government to buy debt? The Minister of Labour has now said that UIF will stop paying out soon. How is it fair to workers who have paid over their money to UIF and the fact that it has been used to buy debt? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks very much, Honorable Murolong. Before I request Comrade Unit to come in, are there other members who want to make comments? Because Comrade Unit will be the second large.
Just before Comrade Unit, Jadu?
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, Chairperson, I want to check with the Treasury on the definition of a balanced budget, the balanced adjustment budget, in line with the reprioritization and the prioritization of funds. Just to give a scenario or in terms of how the balance, the adjustment budget is being balanced in line with the reprioritization and prioritization of funds. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks. Okay. Okay, let me hand over to the Chairperson. Comrade Yunis, can you make your comments?
Yeah, thanks, Comrade Chair. Just very quickly, firstly, I mean, speaking for myself, and I think many other members probably agree, I don't know, but we need to communicate to Treasury, I think, that we are acutely, excruciatingly aware of the dire straits we're in. There's actually no money left in the budget as far as I can see. We're rock bottom. I don't think any of us, well, I can't speak for others. I certainly think that many of us are acutely aware of that. So we need to stress that, right? And we have to be clear that if we completely sink, it's the poor disadvantaged, the constituency of the majority party largely, that will be disproportionately affected, like all over the world where you have severe economic and financial crises. So for that reason too, we're certainly not going to be reckless. At the same time, I've said this before, Comrade Chair, this is actually, I don't know how to put it, an unprecedented situation. There's no guidebook. There is no sense of certainty. There is extreme volatility. So all of us, as I said last week, have to be modest, starting with Treasury. You can't be dogmatic. You can't present yourself as a monopoly of wisdom, because you aren't. Nobody is. Not even the treasuries of the developed world with all the experience of democracy and so on. So I would plead with Treasury to to be more modest and amenable to hearing different points of view. I also think that civil society needs to be modest. That applies equally to economics, economist initiative, BJC, C90, and whoever, COSATU and so on. But so too should we as members of parliament and these members of our two committees. So I think all of us, business, civil society, other sections of civil society apart from labor, you know, all of us. Now, what I want to say is that personally, I said last week, I'm very empathetic with the minister. It's the worst position you can be in, and the DC and so on. And Comrade Chair, I think that we must be very empathetic with them. But at the same time, the minister and deputy minister take the position that the DG did today. The DGs play a different role. You can't on the one hand say that don't conflate the role of a DG with the role of the minister and deputy minister and allow, Comrade Chair, with due respect, a DG to behave the way he did today. Frankly, DG, you might recall, I've been chairing committees since 1998. Five, six committees over the years. Now I'm on the other house as well, SDOP. But let me put this to you, I've never come across this behavior before from any DG. Quite frankly, I agree entirely with Noctolo and to a large extent with Floyd. It's not acceptable, DG. Yes, you must be robust, but you can't tell us as Parliament. That's outrageous, DG, that we shouldn't be misled and used. Who are we going to be used by? It applies equally to you, Treasury. You're not going to mislead us. We won't allow you to. You're not going to use us. We won't allow you to. So let's be clear. It's not a question of being robust. It's a question of you not telling Parliament what to do in respect of civil society. Actually, you know, it's really outrageous. I honestly think your behavior today, and especially coming from you, frankly, because until now, you've been known to be a very modest, soft person and conciliatory, so it took me by surprise personally. Okay, then to come to the other issues, right? Firstly, the thing that struck me more and more, Comrade Chair, is that this is, if you like, a transitional budget. That's why they're calling it a supplementary budget more than an adjustments budget. I think, really, we'll get a better sense of where things are going with the MTBPS in October this year, and certainly with the February 2021 budget. So in a way, we can't give our full opinions on this budget until we get a keener sense of where things are going. And I don't think there's enough of a flesh, if you like, here, enough of a detail here for us to draw any conclusions with. You know, we can have tentative views, but I don't think we can have any conclusive views. I also think that Treasury needs, DG, since you're the senior most person here, perhaps you can answer this question. There's a strong current of thinking in the submissions we receive, but certainly within the ANC, let alone the SACP and COSATU, that there is a discrepancy between the more state-led growth path that the president speaks of. He draws parallels with the Second World War and the Labour Party's intervention in Great Britain. He draws parallels with the 1930s Depression. To what extent is the position set out in the budget reasonably consistent with that path, or is it over-reliant on the private sector to rescue us? Not that the private sector co-chairperson members is not crucial to our recovery. They're indispensable, but we need a relationship in state and market that's appropriate to the current conditions. On the issue, finally, of the economist initiative, I've made a comment there, Comrade Chair, in the chat group. There, Gillard, is that how we say his name? He's unavailable today. He's sick, apparently. But they said they will write their responses, and we plead with them to do so by this evening so that Zakele, Esther, and their team can pull together a draft that the chairs can look at and forward to the committee as soon as possible. And certainly, can I just remind people before I withdraw, Chairperson, that those who haven't submitted their 500-word summary of their representation, can they please do so by 5 o'clock today, because the team has to get going with preparing the report over the weekend. Thank you, Comrade Chair.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, Comrade Eunice, for your comments. Let me take the meeting to closure, but before that, let me make a few comments, then we adjourn the meeting. I think, honorable members, we have got serious issues here in regard to the economy. The economy is declining. There's bloodbath in terms of unemployment. Businesses are closing, revenue is declining. So these need extraordinary measures. And I think, Comrade Eunice, PBO and FFC have made recommendations which are worthwhile for us to consider. They can't just make recommendations and then we ignore them. I think some of them can help us in making recommendations to the House on Wednesday. PBO raised the issue of automatic fiscal stabilizers. I don't have to go into it. It's there in the document. And then also raised the issue of GEPF. We have to discuss the role of GEPF in this regard. And I think there's a reference to regulation, something like Regulation 38 or 28. It's a matter that I think we have to look at. Also, they raised the role of South African Reserve Bank. It can't be that every time we have to discuss South African Reserve Bank, we are reminded about its independence and all this. South African Reserve Bank is not a divine institution. It has been created by the law of Parliament. And if the public and public representatives feel that the role and the mandate of the Reserve Bank has to be expanded or broadened, it is our right to say so, because we can't be in this situation that we are, and we don't see the active role of the Reserve Bank except to cut the repo rate by two whatever basis points. It should come handy in terms of its finance plan in regard to bailing out in the situation that we find ourselves in. PBO again raised the issue of illicit finance, financial capital flight, tax evasion, slippages, and so on, and said that that team that should have reported to us as early as April this year should come back to Parliament and report as to what is it that they are recommending should be done to deal with the issue of illicit financial flow, tax evasions, and so on. Also, FFC has made a number of recommendations that I think we have to consider. This thing that, as I've raised 2 days before, that FFC, which is a credible institution, and they have made evidence-based kind of findings, make recommendations, and we just ignore them. I don't think that should be allowed. To take recommendations coming from PBO, FFC, including the stakeholders, very serious, because they make a whole range of recommendations, including reducing high levels of concentration in the economy, improving land reform and agriculture for food security, reducing the cost of the broadband, and strengthening the state capacity. This is the time when the state should be seen to be playing a very active role. It can't be that we believe that the private sector will come as the messiah and save the country from the problem which we are facing. Now is the time for the state to take a lead in the reconstruction and the recovery of the economy of South Africa. And they raised issues of reviewing of means tests of beneficiaries of government across the board, and also recommend that tax policy should prioritize the fiscal support to ensure that the economy survives the pandemic. And then also, they recommend that all spheres of government must table plans for revenue enhancement and expenditure. I think working with Treasury, we should create a space where all the three spheres should come and table these plans before us. If you have seen the report of PBO and FFC and also the report of the AG, municipalities are in trouble. Almost 79% of them are in trouble. They are collecting far less in terms of revenue. And it can't just we look at it and keep quiet. We have to create a platform where we get revenue enhancement strategies from the three spheres of government as recommended by FFC. But the other critical first issue that they also recommend is the SOE's reform plans. There are so many things which are done in regard to SOEs. However, we don't know what are their plans. It will be important that probably Treasury, working with DPE, privilege this committee, as much as there's another committee somewhere, but this committee, these two committees are responsible for finances, that we be privileged with the SOE reform plans, so that you don't come to this committee and appropriations when you have to deal with the bailout, and we don't know what in the long run you want to achieve. It will be important that we know you appraise us about the short, the medium, and the long-term plans in regard to improving the performance of SOEs. The last issue that I want to raise, at some stage, the minister raised the issue of the zero-based budgeting. I don't know whether now it's a policy matter or it's a view of the minister. We'll have to debate this issue. Has government adopted or wants to move towards zero-based budgeting? If so, there are concerns that government had to look at the budget structure, data, time, and lots of programs that government has committed itself over the past 25 years or so. So we don't believe, DG, that already this is something, is the route that you want to take. It's a very a big decision to take, because it has got serious impact. It's not just a statement that let's move towards zero-based budgeting. There must be presentation. There must be evidence-based research, empirical data. Why do you want to take that direction? So that us as public representatives, we are convinced by that. We don't like a situation where a minister or an official makes a statement, then the following day, it becomes a policy statement and it gets implemented. We can't make policies in that manner. If there is a policy initiative, it must go through the route of public participation, because at the end, it affects the public. And Parliament is the platform where the public participates in terms of making legislation, policies, and so on and so on. But what I was saying, Comrade Yunis, was that let's take into consideration what FFC, PBO members have recommended here. And from here, we are going to compile the report, which we'll present to the committee on Tuesday. Are we meeting on Tuesday in Kuleko, Alan?
Yes, Chair, we are meeting on Tuesday.
Yes, Chair.
Okay, thanks. We'll compile a report. We'll coordinate between ourselves as the select committee and the standing committee and present the draft on Tuesday when we meet. And then we look at draft, that draft, adopt it, and then present it the following day at the National Assembly. Thanks very much, honorable members. Siyabonga, Akeza, Danke,
Chair, sorry.
What?
No, what's the issue, Honorable Lewis? Because we have given you time to make a comment.
I'm just wondering why the Treasury is not responding to our comments, because we asked a series of questions and comments to what the Treasury has presented us today.
No, they were responding when they were doing that.
But no, it's not in our agenda. They were given two items to respond. They presented, stakeholders made comments, and they responded again. We have the last word as Parliament, not the Treasury. We will not allow them to come at the end. We have given them enough time. You as members have made recommendations that we are going to factor them in the report that we are going to present on Tuesday. I believe they will be there on Tuesday when we discuss the report, Honorable. That's the procedure of running the meeting. The host has the last word. It can be the other way around. Thanks very much, Honorable Lewis and other members. Baya danke. Siyabulela, siyathokoza. You can see me.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Siyabulela mhlekazi njani
Siyabulela ngokuphelele.